everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show. I'm Steve Wright from SCDLifestyle.com, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of ChrisKresser.com. Chris, how you doing today?
I'm pretty good, Steve. How are you?
I'm excited. We're about to share the mic with Matt the Kraken Lalonde, and I'm stoked for what you guys are about to share with us.
Yeah, I'm really excited about the show today, too. Can't wait.
So before we get rolling today, if this is the first time you're listening to this show, or if you're new to the paleo diet, or maybe you're just interested in optimizing your health, you're going to want to check out what over 10,000 people have signed up for already, and that's called Beyond Paleo. Now, what's Beyond Paleo? Well, it's a free 13-part email series on Chris's best tips and tricks for burning fat, boosting energy, preventing and reversing disease without drugs. To get this, go over to ChrisKresser.com and look for the big red box.
Okay, so I'm really excited to introduce Matt Lalonde. Matt, why don't you introduce yourself for those of you who don't already know you, and tell us a little bit about your background, what you're doing right now, and how you became interested in the evolutionary approach to nutrition and health.
Yeah, absolutely. I just like to say beforehand that it's a pleasure to be here, and I listen to this podcast every week, so I'm killing two birds with one stone by being on the podcast. And it's also very apropos that we start with a promotion for Beyond Paleo, because I feel like this is going to be, our discussion is going to be about Beyond Paleo.
So, exactly.
A quick intro. My name is Matthew Lalonde. I have a PhD in organic chemistry from Harvard University, also a postdoc in inorganic chemistry from Harvard University. I then decided not to go into industry because I felt like a lot of the drugs that were developed there were addressing diseases of civilization, lifestyle diseases that were better addressed by changing the lifestyle than by taking a drug. Rob Wolf got me interested in this paleo diet thing. I started doing some research on it, and all of the stuff that I know is self-taught, even though I have a pretty solid science background. I'm still not an MD. You can call me doctor because I have a PhD, but I'm not an MD. So, you know, I owe my shift in career, if you will, to Rob and his shenanigans there over.
Yeah, that's a familiar story, I think.
That's right.
So you mentioned that we're going to talk about Beyond Paleo, and I agree. That's probably a good intro to this show, because and maybe just a little word on why I even used that phrase on the website, and why I titled the 13-part email series Beyond Paleo, is that I've always looked at paleo as a starting place and not a destination. And the reason for that, we're going to get into in a lot more detail, but in a nutshell, it's that the paleo diet is a great basic template that we can all follow, but within that template there's a lot of room for individual variation. And then there are also foods that weren't available in the Paleolithic era that I think are beneficial when they're well tolerated by the individual. And we're, of course, going to talk a lot more about that and the science and reasoning behind that. But I wanted to have Matt on the show because Matt has done a lot of work and kind of dedicated himself recently to scientific rigor within the context of the claims made by the paleo diet and you know, people who talk about the paleo diet. And I really appreciate Matt's perspective and his rigor in terms of piecing out what current medical science can say and not say about the paleo diet, and which claims that are made by the paleo diet can and can't be supported by the current evidence. So Matt's talked about this before in a few different venues, but I really wanted to have him come on the show and so we can wrap about it here. So Matt, why don't you give us, you know, a kind of overview of what you're going to talk about, and then we'll jump in.
Absolutely. So, you know, I can quickly cover some of the three main criticisms that I had that I talked about in other venues, including the Ancestral Health Symposium, and then we can go beyond that because I think there's other really interesting things to discuss. before I do that, I'm just going to tell people, you know, straight up, I truly believe in evolution as a scientist. And if you go to YouTube and you type in or you search for Why Evolution is True by Jerry Coyne, you can watch that. And I agree 100% with everything that's on there. And I went to see Jerry when he gave a talk here at Harvard, and he was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I'll also say that the goal of my talk at the Ancestral Health Symposium was to help people better justify why they're using this dietary approach or lifestyle. It was, you know, I do realize that I ruffled some feathers because there are some folks who are coming out of field, and I'm coming out of field, but not that far, you know, chemistry mm-hmm. and medicine that far off. But there are some folks who are coming from different fields, and really all they're grasping on is this evolutionary thing. And they don't realize that all it is really at the end of the day is a great way to formulate hypotheses. And I was mm-hmm. seeing a lot of mistakes made in the blogosphere, and I was afraid that it was going to prevent a lot of professionals from taking our movement seriously. So that was the goal ultimately. And, you know, it's just so simple to ridicule the whole caveman argument that I wanted to go beyond that. I wanted to give people a little bit more to think about. So if you are on a paleo diet, or what I prefer to say, actually, because there's really no such thing as a paleo diet, the foods aren't available anymore. You can try to mimic it. It's the best you can do. Right. A diet that's meat, vegetables, tubers, and fruits. That's mm-hmm. what we call it. Typical arguments for this will go like that. Our ancestors and modern hunter-gatherers consumed a diet that was mostly devoid of grains, legumes, and dairy, and they were virtually free of diseases of civilization. People then make the invalid inference that consuming a diet mostly devoid of grains, legumes, and dairy will thus allow us to be free of diseases of civilization. Why is this invalid? Well, Chris, maybe you can reiterate your shark attack analogy for us.
Sure. Yeah. So it's been observed for quite some time that when people consume more ice cream, there's an increase in shark attacks. So obviously that means that eating ice cream increases your risk of getting attacked by a shark, right, Matt?
Of course. Yeah, probably you eat too much ice cream and then you drown in the sea, and then, you know, you move around a lot and the sharks are attracted to you and your right. blood tastes sweet.
Right. So maybe there's another explanation.
Maybe it's because the temperature is rising.
Uh-huh.
No way. No way.
So the temperature goes up and more people go in the water, and then more people get attacked by sharks.
That's correct. Uh-huh. And when the temperature goes up, there's also more people that eat ice cream because it's cold and it's yummy.
Ah, so yes, this is a perfect example of why we have to be careful assuming that correlation equals causation, which we've talked about, of course, many times on this show.
That is correct. So temperature here is what we call, you know, a variable that wasn't observed, a confounding factor, in that it mm-hmm. it's involved in everything. And there's a lot of that goes on in these observational epidemiologies. You can't observe everything, so there's almost always going to be, especially when it comes to human beings that are very complex and multivariate, that live in a very complex and multivariate environment.
Yeah.
You are never going to see everything. So observational epidemiology is great for formulating hypotheses and asking questions, but it doesn't answer any questions. The same is true about this statement. You know, it's just an observation. It's just a correlation. You can't say for sure that, yes, it is the case that if we eat like that, we're going to avoid the diseases of civilization. So you have to be very, very careful with that.
Right. But as you pointed out earlier in the show, it's reasonable to use that as a starting place. That's an interesting observation, and maybe we can do some further investigation and see whether that's actually true.
Absolutely. So let's move on to the second one. This is one that I see often. It goes something like this. We evolved over millions of years without consuming the foods that became readily available only after the advent of agriculture. Hence, we're not adapted to these foods. But this assumes that a species isn't adapted to a food because it's never consumed it. And if you look at the evolutionary record, that's incorrect. There's plenty of examples throughout evolution where species discover novel sources of food and thrive on them.
Like humans and meat?
Exactly. I was just about to say, you know, humans started out by eating fruits, plants, insects. Then they scavenged bone marrow from bones, and they also brains from skulls, and eventually became some of the meanest, baddest hunters on the planet.
Right. So, right, and that changed our physiology along the way, right? We went from having a much larger gut that was good for fermenting rough cellulose and carbohydrate to a much smaller gut and a bigger brain.
Yeah, so you look at the expensive tissue hypothesis, and then, you know, I'm at Harvard, so I have to mention Richard Wrangham. Cooking also had a huge, huge part to play in that.
So, right.
You know, when you cooked plant matter or meat, it became more easily digestible, so your gut could get a little bit smaller and you got better nutrition as a result. If you look throughout history, you'll see that food itself is a huge driver of evolution. You know, the availability of food has driven some major adaptations. And that's another part where I didn't ruffle some feathers, but I think I was misinterpreted during my seminar talk at AHS, where some people seem to think that I was implying that adaptation was very quick. And I didn't say that. I said that adaptation depended on time and pressure. And right. If the pressure is very high, then it can be very quick. So European herders becoming adapted to lactose, for example, would be, you know, that would be a great example.
Yeah, so let's talk about genetics a little bit longer than we've talked about the last two, because I'm personally fascinated by genetics and epigenetics, and I think it's a good example of where an argument that seems like it makes a lot of sense on the surface can go wrong once you start to understand more of the science behind it. So
absolutely. So that's my third criticism, actually, if you want me to get that out of the way.
Yeah, do that.
We'll launch us into genetics and epigenetics, because the third thing I hear a lot is our genes are virtually identical to those of our Paleolithic ancestors, so we should live like they did. And this has to be the most ridiculous statement of them all, because here is a group of people that claims to take an evolutionary approach to life, yet shows it does not understand evolution. Human beings and chimps have virtually identical genomes to the tune of 99.5%. The difference between a human being and a chimp is in gene expression in the epigenome. Just because two species have similar genes does not mean that they will both thrive in similar environments or with similar food sources. You know, one of the mechanisms through which adaptations arise is a change in gene expression. It would be absurd to suggest the epigenome of modern humans is identical to that of our Paleolithic ancestors, given the substantial changes in environment and food that have occurred since that era.
Right. And this is what's so interesting to me is that when we talk about the pace of change, epigenetic changes can happen very quickly. You know, we're talking about pressure for genetic changes, and that can actually happen more quickly than most people think. So you mentioned lactase persistence, or our ability to digest lactose into adulthood. Well, that's happened, as you know, Matt, within the last 8,000 years, which is actually pretty quick in terms of, you know, evolutionary history.
That's a blink of an eye.
So there's a study in 2007 where researchers looked at DNA from skeletons of people who died in Northern or Central Europe about 7,000 to 8,000 years ago, and there was zero. None of them had lactase persistence at that time. And then another study from the Bronze Age about 3,000 years ago of a similar population found that about 25% had the allele for lactase persistence. And then today, in some Scandinavian countries, I think like Sweden and Denmark, lactase persistence has reached about 95% penetrance in the population. And the cattle herding tribe, Tutsi tribe in East Africa, I think has about 90% lactase persistence. So that's a huge genetic change in a short period of time. But even that period of time is incredibly long compared to how quickly some of these epigenetic changes can happen, right?
Absolutely.
So like, a good example, you might even know this study in 2003, the fat yellow mice, you know, that always give birth to other fat yellow mice. And researchers gave these, they separated them into two groups, and one group was the control, and the other group they gave supplements that improve methylation, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a second. And the group that got these methylation supplements, guess what? They didn't give birth to fat yellow mice like you would expect them to. They gave birth to skinny brown mice instead. And the amazing thing is the genes were exactly the same in these babies. They were right where they were supposed to be, but the supplements had turned off or silenced the gene that make these mice fat.
Yeah, I think they're agouti mice.
Agouti mice, that's exactly right. And so this process of genetic suppression, which is epigenetics, is called DNA methylation. And we've talked a little bit about methylation before, and I think I talked a lot about it on a show with Rob, but methylation occurs when a methyl group binds to a gene and changes the way it expresses itself. So this can happen. I mean, these changes are triggered by environmental factors. They can happen. Some of the recent research suggests that even the first few days after conception, some of these profound epigenetic changes are happening due to methylation, turning genes on and off just in a matter of days after conception in the womb. So that's, we can say that it does take often genetic changes a very long time to happen. But on the other end of the spectrum, we've got these epigenetic changes that can happen in utero and during our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. And, since you mentioned that, there's a lot of people that now believe that, genetics has nothing to do with obesity. And I highly disagree. If you imagine this happening in human beings, the plumper yellow mouse would be at a huge disadvantage, from the start relative to the lean, darker mouse.
Right. And then there's the developmental origins hypothesis, which I've talked about before, and where David Barker, a researcher in the UK, found that 20 years ago that babies that are born at a very low birth weight are more likely to become obese and experience metabolic problems later in life. Because if this happened, for example, during, in a hunter-gatherer population or time during the Paleolithic, and a baby was born into a time of scarcity and famine, they might experience epigenetic changes that made their metabolism more efficient at extracting calories and hoarding energy, because that would have helped them survive in that environment. But today, if you have a mother who's poorly nourished during gestation, and that baby is born with that same thrifty metabolism into an environment where you can walk down to any corner and get unbelievably calorically dense food, at any time you want, then that thrifty phenotype, which helped that baby survive, in a time of food scarcity, would cause things like obesity and diabetes and heart disease today.
Absolutely. So, there's a lot of people that have asked me, well, what do you want me to say then? If I want to use the evolutionary approach, and we haven't talked about the anti-nutrient, but this is a crossroads here, what do you say? And the statement I used in my talk, I said, you could say this. There's been insufficient time and evolutionary pressure for complete adaptation to seed consumption to arise in Homo sapiens. And I think about that today, and I'm like, well, people might think that there could be complete adaptation. Let's say you were to take a population and give them only wheat to eat. But unfortunately, I don't think that's the case, because all evolution cares about is getting to the next generation. And eating these foods will allow you to reach reproductive age. You can think of, if some people think, well, that's silly, it's not. There are certain types of insects that live only long enough to reproduce, and then they die off, and then the next generation takes over.
And it wasn't that long ago that humans didn't survive on average that much longer than reproductive age due to acute illness. So the
challenge right now is that we are trying to live for a very long time and very well and healthy. So, we're pushing the boundaries.
Yeah, this is... like I said, this is so fascinating to me. What you just said about what we can say with some certainty really matches another quote that I recently read. I'll have to look up the researchers that said this, but they said, given the long human generation time and the fact that agriculture represents less than 1% of our evolutionary history, it's unlikely that we've evolved any complex adaptations to an agricultural or industrial way of life. So that we've evolved some what might be called shallow adaptations or mutations. And some examples of this kind of rapid genetic change are the evolution of light skin in response to humans moving into northern climates, or the changes in some genes or gene expression that regulate insulin metabolism in response to a higher carbohydrate diet. But those are relatively simple mutations. They're not complex adaptations, which are, you know, characteristics that involve coordinated actions of many different genes together.
When you think about these two statements, what I like about it is that it's pinpointing what I think is a fact, and that people who are adapted to grains and legumes, or who, you know, not necessarily thrive but survive on these foods, are probably the minority. They're not right. The majority.
That's because there hasn't been enough pressure, right, to make that a majority trait.
That's right. Now, that's very different than saying, well, nobody should eat this because we've never eaten these foods in the past. And it is a very different statement, and it forces people to think about themselves, which is what you do all the time. It's like, okay, where do I sit on this spectrum? What do I tolerate and what do I not tolerate?
Right. And that's why I have a problem with this kind of arguments. Let's take dairy, which I know we're going to talk about when we talk about anti-nutrients. But one of the typical arguments you hear about why humans shouldn't be eating dairy is that no other animal drinks the milk, you know, of another animal, right? Mm-hmm. So therefore, humans should not drink the milk of another animal. Well, no, as far as I know, no other animals are cooking their food either.
Yeah, and again, it assumes that you can't possibly discover a better source of food, right? It's this ridiculous assumption that can't be the case. What if the milk of another animal is this great food that we haven't tapped to in the past?
Right. And there may be reasons to avoid dairy, which we're going to discuss, but that's not the reason.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, so Let's move into the anti-nutrients, because I know you've done a lot of work on that, and I would really love to sort through the fact and fiction there.
Absolutely. And that was the second part of the talk. And, you know, there's some people that accuse me of being really condescending during that talk. And I haven't said this up until now for the sake of the community, but I'll say it now because I don't think it matters. But I had been giving a nutrition talk for a long time, and I'd been relying on anti-nutrient information that came from a talk that was given to me by Lauren Cordain. And it turns out that most of the information that was in there that I never bothered to double check, I should have double checked, was wrong. And, you know, when I was standing up there and I was really condescending, that was to him. Like, I was like, listen, dude, like we need to have a match right here, right now, because you have been putting out this information and it's completely wrong. And I can discuss where the failings are.
Let's do that. I mean, that seems like it'd be a useful starting place, is figuring out, you know, what are the typical claims made about anti-nutrients and which of those are right and which of those are wrong.
That's right. So there are definitely proteins in grains, in legumes, and in dairy that are very immunogenic and or allergenic, and those aren't necessarily the same thing. And one of the biggest problem, or I should say maybe the most well-studied, is the fact that there are peptides derived from the digestion of gliadin, which is a part of gluten, that increase intestinal permeability. And that increase in intestinal permeability can lead to a very wide variety of problems. That is correct. We need more information. Probably, I would say, gluten and casein are some of the best studied peptides or proteins. There are other proteins and legumes that are known to be very allergenic, specifically soy, but people don't seem to make as big of a fuss. And here I do mean allergenic, not necessarily immunogenic. Some of them are immunogenic, but the reaction tends to be allergenic, like people have an allergy to soy, for example.
So Matt, can you, for some of our lay listeners, explain what immunogenic means?
Yes, so it's going to activate parts of the immune system, but it's not going to activate immunoglobulin E, which would be responsible for an allergy, for example. So it will cause inflammation. It will cause some problems. It will activate the immune system, but not necessarily lead to, you know, for example, anaphylactic shock.
So this is the difference between when we talk about food intolerances versus food allergies, or an allergy versus an intolerance.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, if you are trying to sell this lifestyle to someone and you needed something else other than, because again, there's going to be a continuum here and there's going to be plenty of people that are going to tell you, well, I have no problem with gluten and casein, so can I eat those things? And, you know, we've already discussed the whole paleo caveman arguments. What else can you say? Well, there's two to three things that come to mind for me. Well, meat, vegetables, tubers, and fruits are the most nutrient-dense foods. Anyone can look that up online. The food palatability reward that Stéphane Guiné loves to talk about, turns out that if you're eating unprocessed meat, vegetables, tubers, and fruits, that's very satiating because they contain fiber, and fiber will deliver nutrients to the small intestine at the end of the small intestine, and that triggers satiety. And they're also very unlikely to create cravings or trigger overconsumption. You don't hear anybody say, I ate 10 pounds of broccoli.
Or sweet potatoes. Yeah.
Sweet potatoes, yeah. So that's another one. And then the agriculture of corn and wheat is not sustainable as currently practiced. So those are three other things you can say. Why are you eating something that's right next to junk food and nutrient density and all that stuff?
So Matt, let's talk a little bit about phytic acid, because this is something that's received a lot of attention. And this is something that my view on has evolved since I first started writing about it and since I've learned more about it. So what are some of the truths about phytic acid and the risks of phytic acid? And what are some of the myths about phytic acid that you see in the paleo community?
Yeah, I think the misconception, and I'll be honest, I had this misconception, is that consuming a food that contains phytic acid is going to steal nutrients away from you. But it turns out that phytic acid in the food is most commonly bound to and metal ion already. So the phytic acid, or phytates, there are other derivatives. Phytic acid is myo-inositol hexaphosphate, but you can have pentaphosphate, tetraphosphate, and triphosphate isomers that were also going to form various complexes with metal ions, precipitate them out of solution, and prevent their absorption. So what this stuff does, it just means that if you look at, say, the iron content of kale, well, you're not going to absorb all the iron that you see because some of it is bound to phytic acid or phytates.
Right. So it reduces the absorption of a mineral in the food that it's in, but it's not chelating minerals from your body.
Exactly. Unless you were to supplement with free phytic acid for some reason. Maybe if you have primary hemochromatosis, that
would be sufficient to you. Yeah, I sometimes do that in patients that can't get phlebotomy for some reason or another. Another interesting thing that you and I have corresponded about this via email, and you sent me some interesting studies, is some of the foods which, you know, we talk about phytic acid in nuts and in grains, but actually some of the foods that are highest in phytic acid are foods that are, quote, safe in the paleo diet, right?
Yeah, like green leafy vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think was spinach pretty high, all the green leafy ones.
Yeah, huh? Spinach, purslane, kale, they're very high not just in phytic acid, but in other naturally occurring phytochemicals that will bind iron. So the polyphenols, for example, they can bind iron. What else? Oxalic acid, that can bind iron and other minerals. You know, they are rich in tannins. Tannins can also do that. They're rich in a variety of compounds that can bind minerals. So if you look at it, I think I sent you this study where they were looking at the bioavailability, specifically of iron in this case, from plant sources versus animal sources. The animal sources was always better.
Right. Yeah, heme iron is, and it's also much better absorbed, and that's probably the main reason.
Yeah.
So, Chris, before we move on, in your nut article about phytic acid, you also talked about the fact that it could interfere with pepsin and amylase. Is that something that is still true even when the phytic acid is usually bound to an ion?
Maybe. It's the phosphate group that fits into the active site of the enzyme. Maybe, but my guess is that is mostly with the free material. But it is known to inhibit some digestive enzymes. However, that was an in vitro study. So you would have to go look at the dose that was employed in that in vitro study and the amount of food you would have to consume to come anywhere close to that.
Replicate that, yeah. And what about cooking methods and phytic acid?
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, soaking will get rid of some phytic acid. If you really want to get rid of it, though, fermentation is the way to go. So fermentation has been shown time and time again to improve the bioavailability of minerals when there's phytic acid or phytates in the food. And that's because they just cleave off the phosphate group and it leaves phosphate and myo-inositol. The phytic acid, by the way, is a self-fermentation system for the plant. You know how we add phosphorus to our crops? Well, the plant already has that. The seed already has that in it.
Right. So I think this points to, I mean, this is a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's relevant, is the danger of nutritionism that we can fall into. I can't believe I'm spacing on his name. Colin Campbell's study that shows that casein causes cancer. Isolated casein causes cancer, but when casein appears in dairy, it also contains whey, which is anti-carcinogenic. And bringing this back to phytate or phytic acid, just because a food has some potentially toxic effects, it doesn't mean we can't tolerate that food in some small amounts. And you see this, it's all about the dose. You see this with a lot of things that we eat. And in a food-based form, they might be fine and not problematic. But then when you isolate them and turn them into a supplement and take them at high doses, they become very problematic.
Yeah, and polyphenols would be one of those.
I was just going to say resveratrol is a great example of that.
Yeah, there's a U-curve associated with that for sure.
Yeah, with a lot of minerals and vitamins and nutrients, there's that U-curve.
Yeah.
No, I mean, iron is another good example of iron deficiency anemia affects 2 billion people worldwide, and it's a huge problem. But iron overload is also a really big problem, and it's one that is a lot less known, and I see a lot in my practice. That's actually going to be the subject of my talk at AHS this year.
However, if you were to supplement with too much iron, the mechanism for absorption is very well controlled if you do not have primary hemochromatosis. So
that's true. It's
just going to be excreted. But that's why a lot of these iron supplements constipate people.
Yeah, but the problem is that hemochromatosis is the most common genetic mutation in people of Northern European descent. So it's between 1 in 200 and 1 in 300. And that's for people who are homozygous for the mutation. And then you have heterozygous or carriers, and there's a lot of recent evidence that suggests that people who are carriers have a mildly increased risk of iron overload. Not as significant, of course, as people with primary hereditary hemochromatosis who are homozygous for the mutation. But I see a lot of people in my practice who are just carriers for the mutation, and they still have, you know, ferritin levels in the 400, 500, 600, 700s, iron saturation as high as 70%. And these are folks that have adopted a paleo diet, which is, of course, beneficial in many ways, but it's very iron rich. And so all of a sudden you start to see their ferritin and iron saturation go through the roof.
You know, before I forget, on the subject of phytic acid, we started talking about cancer. There are some studies out there that you can find that those compounds they're toxic to cancer cells. However, again, be careful. Those studies are in vitro. You would then have to run a study where a human being is consuming this compound, phytic acid, see how much of it can actually get in the bloodstream, bioaccumulate in the tumor in the proper concentration that was used in that study to then kill a cell. And in my opinion, my frank opinion, this is never going to happen. This will never be used as an anti-cancer drug because there are so many other detrimental effects associated with too much phytic acid that, you know, it's nonsense. So the people that defend phytic acid using those studies, I'm sorry, I don't buy it.
Before we roll on here, guys, let me see if I can summarize this phytic acid and then ask one more question for those of us who aren't as deep into the research and the chemistry as you guys are. So you're telling us that phytic acid is normal to most plants and that it's actually usually bound, and majority of it's bound to a mineral already, and that unless we were actually taking it already separated, it's not actually going to leach anything, and therefore are you actually saying that we shouldn't worry about this anymore, that it's not going to hurt us just because it's inside of a plant?
There are bigger fish to fry. No, you should not be worrying about this, in my opinion.
But it does mean that if you were figuring that you were going to absorb a lot of nutrients from oats, for example, or brown rice, you may not be absorbing as much as you thought you would be because of the phytic acid content, unless you ferment them or prepare them extensively beforehand.
Okay, so the biggest takeaway there is that I think Matt alludes to this in some of his talks, but we don't burn calories inside of some sort of kiln or something. So we're not going to be getting all of the magnesium or all of the minerals that is said on these supposed superfoods.
No, so you should see the way that they determine that. You know, they just burn the compound, they do an elemental analysis, and determine that there's this much iron in it. There's no way you're going to absorb all of that. It's not going to happen, whether it's meat or plant matter, no, animal or plant matter. You're never going to absorb everything.
So, Matt, let's talk about white potatoes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's another one of my favorite. And, you know, this one fits this. Well, it wasn't available before the advent of agriculture, so we probably shouldn't be eating it. Again, assuming that we cannot find a better source of food compared to what was in the Paleolithic. And this is another one where I covered it that at length in my AHS talk, showing the actual molecular structures of these molecules. So some of them are they're glycosides. They're either terpene glycosides or they're alkaloid glycosides. So they're called saponins or glycoalkaloids. And Cordain makes this huge, huge deal about them, saying that they cause intestinal permeability and whatnot. If you look at those permeability studies, they are all in vitro. Mm-hmm. And my problem with them is that if you're a chemist and you look at these substances, they're like, wow, there's glycoside bonds all over the place. This is going to fall apart during digestion. Sure enough, it does. Sometimes you can find certain metabolites of it in the bloodstream, but you rarely find that compound itself. It has never been shown in a human being that consuming a lot of this stuff is going to increase intestinal permeability. The only studies that I find where this stuff can be problematic is where they use mice models of intestinal bowel disease, mm-hmm. where like, there's some kind of genetic manipulation that was done. They feed those mice models fried potato skins. And they're fried in polyunsaturated oils, by the way.
Right. So you take the part of the tuber that has the highest concentration of toxins, which is the skin, and then you fry it in seed oil.
Yeah, in a mouse model of IBD. And right. If you do that, you see inflammation, biomarkers of inflammation increase. Right. So if, and this is a big if, that translates to human beings, all you'd be able to say is that people with irritable bowel disease should not be eating fried potato skins ad libitum. If you think that's a ridiculous statement, you're right.
Right.
and if you look at the potatoes, I think Stefan Guinet had a really good post on that. There's only one species that has a significant amount of these saponins in the flesh, and it's the Snowden potato. And it turns out the Snowden is not available on the shelves. It goes directly to making potato chips.
Mm-hmm. Right, fried in polyunsaturated fat.
That's right. So. But if you look at the potato, it has a decent amount of nutrient density. It actually has complete protein for plant matter. That's important for vegetarians. The same is true of the sweet potato varieties, even though they're completely different. I know that they're not the same species. It's actually good food, and it's just starch, you know, which will decompose into glucose. There's no fructose there. So I don't see the problem. Like, have your potatoes, just don't eat the skin if you're worried about it. But the people that make a big fuss about that, again, I think you're losing some credibility here, because really, are you serious?
Right. Yeah. And of course, we want to be clear here. That doesn't mean that, you know, there may not be other reasons not to eat potatoes. Like, for example, some people are sensitive to nightshades and they just don't do well with potatoes. But that's a far cry from saying that nobody should eat them.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's an individual thing. There was a really good post on Rob's site about the woman that was doing the interviews at the last AHS. After the whole conference went down, she figured out that she had a huge nightshade sensitivity. It caused a condition, the name of which I can't remember or pronounce, even if it was in front of me. Mm-hmm. But she was essentially getting pustules, I think, in genital regions, as well as underneath the arms, that are very, very sensitive. And she found out that nightshades were causing it.
Yeah. So again, it's this question of what can the research say, what's a good starting place, and then what are individual tweaks that we might need to make based on our own unique epigenetic phenotype.
Yeah. You want to talk about lectins?
Yeah, lectins, of course. Well, that's the main one we haven't talked about.
Yeah, that's. I think that's, of all of them, that's the one I was most upset about. And that's where I started making myself sort of a matrix for analyzing anti-nutrients. And I presented this at the AHS talk, and you can go back and look at the slides. But there's these 10 questions that I ask myself to determine whether or not this thing's going to be problematic. And if you look at lectins, they fill out, they get a check on almost every question. Like, yes, this is going to be problematic, save for one. One thing you should ask yourself, is this going to survive the cooking process? Another question is it going to survive digestion? But in this case, it turns out that most lectins, especially the most well-studied ones like wheat germ agglutinin, PHA, which is in legumes, which is phytohemagglutinin, they are deactivated by heat. These proteins are very sensitive to heat and they're destroyed. So there's, people like, waving their hands in the air like, oh my God, these things are really toxic and whatnot. And it's true. They are very toxic. We have the research to show that they are toxic in animals in vitro when they're fed to animals. But it turns out that they're feeding raw legumes or pure isolated proteins to these things, not cooked food.
Right. Most people aren't eating wheat right off the stalk, right?
You can't.
No.
I noticed I was very upset with that. It turns out that, yeah, indeed, they could be very problematic, but they're destroyed during the cooking process, and you can't eat grains or legumes without cooking them. Improperly cooked legumes are going to make you very sick. You're going to have some serious GI distress, and it is probably due to the lectin, but that doesn't mean that it actually does get in the bloodstream and cause problems. There is, however, this is something that we should look at on a case-by-case basis. There are some lectins that are not deactivated by heat that do survive digestion, make their way into the bloodstream, and are likely very allergenic. And one of those is peanut lectin. And that research has been done. If you have people eat raw or roasted peanuts and you look at the level of lectin that goes into their blood within 1 hour of consuming those peanuts, you see the lectin levels rise. So there are some that are dangerous, but you should not assume that an entire class of chemicals, or that all of them are dangerous if they haven't been individually tested. And the reason I say that is because when it comes to drug development, and I did work for a few pharmaceutical companies, you can change a minute, like a tiny part of a molecule, and completely change its activity. So for me, unless you know that there's some serious sequence homology here, you can't assume that the proteins are going to be problematic because they're in the same family.
Fascinating stuff. I love it.
So, summary, don't eat peanuts.
Those are probably, I would say one of the worst. There's a good
We could probably say they're the most likely to cause reaction. And so if you eat them and you have any reason to suspect that you're reacting to it, pay close attention. A lot of this stuff boils down to, like we've been saying all along, using this information to then test it out yourself and see how you do. And there are certain foods that I think it's pretty safe to say should just be avoided because they have no nutritional benefit. They're full of anti-nutrients or toxins, and there's no reason to eat them because there are other better choices to make. And then there are foods like meat and vegetables and fruits and tubers that are very well tolerated, very nutrient dense, have been eaten by humans for thousands of generations, and are probably for most people, a really solid choice. And then there's a whole bunch of foods that are in what we might call a gray area, like dairy being the biggest category, where they are certainly nutrient dense and have a lot to offer if they're well tolerated by the individual. And that's, of course, the whole concept behind Beyond Paleo and the Personal Paleo Code is nobody can answer that question for you. There's no magic questionnaire or blood type test or whatever kind of, test that can tell you exactly what you can and can't eat. The only way that you can figure that out is through experimentation.
Yeah, I agree. And, something I'd like to say about dairy, when people ask me about it, I say, the casein can be problematic, lactose can be problematic, So the best macronutrient, the least problematic macronutrient in dairy is the fat.
Right.
When I say that, people are like, oh,
butter, cream.
Fat or the whey, because I've yet to see any problems with whey. Maybe you have. I'd say the fat and the whey are probably the best components of the dairy.
I've seen very rare reactions to whey, but it's 99.9% lactose free from what I understand.
Yep.
And butter has 80 times more fat than casein or lactose, and butter is made from cream. Cream has a little bit more lactose, but most people, even if they don't tolerate milk, in my experience, can tolerate butter and very often can tolerate cream. And then, of course, it depends whether they're sensitive to lactose or casein. If they're sensitive to lactose, they can often tolerate fermented dairy, because if you ferment the dairy for long enough, it's virtually, you know, very low in lactose as well. So it's really pays to do this kind of experimentation, because if you're sensitive to dairy, you got to figure out what you're sensitive to. Are you sensitive to the casein or the lactose? If it's the lactose, you can still enjoy just about any dairy product, actually, except for milk. You can enjoy hard cheeses that have almost no lactose. You can enjoy fermented dairy that you make at home that has almost no lactose. And you can enjoy butter and very often cream. So the only one that you wouldn't be able to eat would be lactose. If you're casein intolerant, that's a little harder, because a lot of cheese has significant amounts of casein.
Well, it's concentrated casein, right? Because the whey is gone.
And then fermentation doesn't, as far as I, actually, have you seen anything on this, Matt? I never have. But what fermentation does to casein, if anything?
It can begin the digestion process a little bit. Yeah.
Right.
There might still be some problematic epitopes left in there. So
if we could say possibly that fermentation might improve tolerance of dairy for people that are casein intolerant, but probably not completely.
No, I wouldn't say completely.
So, Matt, I want to just ask you something that kind of ties the two parts of the show together based on something you said a little bit earlier in the first part of the show. So in the first part, we talked about evolution and epigenetics and how there hasn't been sufficient time yet for adaptation. And you said something about surviving and thriving for some people on seeds. Now we've talked about all the potential anti-nutrients. And so I want to ask you, you said there's a sliding scale here, and we may fall on any part of this scale. Is there a group of people who actually fall on the thriving part of the scale for seeds?
I could be completely wrong here, but I like to think of things I'm a scientist, like in a mathematical bell curve kind of way. And I imagine I see this as a bell curve, and most people are intolerant, but there's probably a few people on the fringe that exist right now that could, thrive on this. They probably exist.
Yeah, and they're more likely from the Middle East somewhere, because agriculture has existed there for longer than it has anywhere else. And there's been, the most pressure and time for them to adapt. So, I would agree with Matt, and I would say that probably getting to the point where we thrive on grains is more of a complex adaptation rather than a simple adaptation. I mean, it would involve more than one mutation and change. And so it's more likely that would take a longer period of time and wouldn't be as prevalent in the population yet.
And I don't think that's something that would be desirable, because grain agriculture is not sustainable. And then, you'd have to develop all kinds of extra protein chomping machinery, because plant protein is typically more difficult to digest than animal protein. And we'd have to be very economical with, recycling of nutrients and whatnot. Because if you look at wheat, at grains in general, the nutritional content is low.
Yeah, it's really not a nutrient dense food. And it's particularly less nutrient dense because, as you pointed out, the topsoil is becoming more and more depleted in nutrients, and we only have, by some estimates, half, like 50 years of topsoil left if we keep this up.
Yeah, the problem is that with the fertilizer, we're only adding in potassium, well, NPK, right? Nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. And there's like 20, 30 other minerals that could be added to the soil that are just being depleted. Magnesium is one of them that keeps being depleted. So, yeah, that is a big problem.
So are you both saying that we should buy the fact that our fruits and vegetables definitely have less nutrients than what they had even 50 years ago?
I buy that.
That's depending on where they're grown. That's a possibility. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a big stretch to understand that the nutrients in fruits and vegetables depend heavily on the soil that they're grown in. And it's pretty well known that there's been big changes in the soil and that a monocrop kind of situation is going to produce very different soil characteristics than a sort of small organic farm. Okay, so we're getting close to the end of the hour here. We have, of course, you know, 92 questions that people submitted for Matt because he's extremely popular guest and everyone wants to hear what he thinks about this stuff. So we're obviously not going to get to those questions, but we have, I picked a few and I'm just going to pull this up and see. We won't even be able to answer all the ones I picked. So let's start with the one from Allie, Steve.
Okay. So this question comes from Allie from Facebook, and she asks, I've heard mixed messages in Paleoville about cooking temperatures. Is there any validity to slow, low cooking being the ultimate way to cook? I understand that charring food can't be good, but does low and slow really make that much of a difference over, say, baking at 350 degrees?
I did read quite a bit of research on that. I forget why. You know, I'm also a nerd just like Chris, and sometimes I go off on what I call a nerd safari. It's just like I start exploring a subject and following references of references of references, and it never ends. And then I raise my head at the end of the day, and it's
8 hours later.
That's right, 8 hours later. It's like, wow, that was fun. A lot of the studies I've read have specifically dealt with digestibility. And with digestibility, yes, it makes a big difference. Slow cooking is always going to lead to a more easily digestible piece of food, cooking in general. So charring is bad. And then charring is also bad because you can oxidize some of the sensitive compounds that are in the food that you eat. So from a oxidation standpoint and a digestibility standpoint, cooking does really seem to be the way to go. I found that was a head scratcher because you've got this the raw food vegan movement being very popular right now, and they're talking about enzymes and this and that, and the research doesn't support it. And I'll tell you right now, enzymes that are in food are they're probably sensitive, and if you heat that, they might if you eat that, they might be destroyed during the digestion process. So I'm not sure to what extent they can be beneficial. I could be wrong on that, but nevertheless, the research doesn't support the raw thing.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, this is kind of another situation where we say, oh, well, our ancestors cooked at high temperatures, therefore that's good. I mean,
that's not necessarily true either. However, so yes, sometimes they cooked over fire, but it was like high over fire, sometimes directly, in some cases, and other times they would take hot rocks and
bury
it in the ground. So there's it's not always directly on fire.
So is there any reason to eat raw meat then?
You know what? I did that for a while. I didn't see any benefit from it. And then I did some research, and it was shown that it was less digestible than the stuff that was slow cooked. And of course, if you don't want to get sick from some pretty nasty pathogens, it's probably if you cook your meat.
Yeah. You know, Stefan Guinea sent me a stack of about 9 papers on cooking temperature, and I, to be honest, haven't had a chance to get to them yet. I've read all the abstracts, and Stefan has actually written quite a bit about this, and he's pretty convinced that low temperature is the way to go. This is one of those things that falls into the category of I don't obsess over it. So I think the research, it seems to indicate that slow cooking is probably better in terms of absorption, like Matt has said, and that really high temperature cooking and charring is potentially problematic and potentially carcinogenic due to the oxidative damage that can occur. But for me personally, that doesn't mean that I will never eat something that comes off of a grill. It just means that that's not my primary cooking method. You know, I don't cook every meal on a grill. A couple times a week, I'll get out there and grill up a ribeye steak. I love that. You have to pry that out of my cold, dead hands.
Absolutely.
So I'm not going to give that up because I think that in the context of an overall healthy diet that's low in oxidant, things that promote oxidative damage and that we can tolerate that. You know, we can tolerate some of these hormetic, you know, some of these stressors, and perhaps they even have a hormetic effect. Who knows?
Now, Ali gives a specific temperature, 350, and I'd have to ask, well, how long? Was there any visible, you know, darkening, charring? Mm-hmm. That temperature might not necessarily be bad. But, you know, to get back to what you were saying, Chris, I was very skeptical of the ages hypothesis from an exogenous standpoint, meaning if you eat it as opposed to if it forms in your body. If it forms in your body because of excess glucose levels or metabolites of glucose, then yes, it's bad. But eating it, I was like, really? This stuff's going through digestion. Is it really going to get into the bloodstream? But there's one that I know of, randomized controlled trial that came out where the people were eating the exact same food. The only thing that differed was the cooking temperature. And the people that consumed the food that was cooked at the lower temperatures had better insulin sensitivity. So I was like, okay.
So this is a great question from Andy on Google Plus. And he asks, how solid is the research on gluten cross-reactivity? And he wants to know, especially with coffee, are there any respected studies by anyone besides the lab that sells the cross-reactivity array?
The lab he's talking about, by the way, is Cyrex Labs. And this is a lab that does, I think, really excellent gluten sensitivity testing and some other really fascinating autoimmune markers that they have. And they have a panel there for people that already know they have gluten intolerance that looks at what other foods that they might be cross-reacting with. And according to their, you know, this is not published peer-reviewed research, but according to their internal research, meaning they've looked at all of the test results for this particular cross-reaction panel, and the most common food that people with gluten intolerance cross-react to, according to their test results, is coffee. And so, you know, a lot of people have asked me, you know, does that mean if I'm gluten intolerant, I shouldn't drink coffee? And I don't think we can make that jump. That's interesting evidence, but it's, of course, there's nothing there that explains the mechanism. It's not, you know, this hasn't been shown in a clinical trial. There's not even epidemiological evidence here that suggests this.
What kind of assay is that, Chris? Is it an antibody assay?
Yeah, it is.
Because the cross-reactivity that I'm most familiar with is from an allergic standpoint. Like if you're allergic to peanuts, you're likely to cross-react with other legumes. So like IgE, essentially.
Right, IgE, allergy, yeah. So this is something that I think I'm going to have to say, we'll get, at least speaking personally, I'll get back to you on it because I need to look into it further. From a very practical perspective, I don't know how important it is because still my response to this in terms of how I work with patients is take it out for, you know, a month and add it back in and see what happens. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, that's really what it comes down to. I have a number of patients who've come to me with, you know, they've had testing at other labs that suggest that they're casein intolerant. And I don't even necessarily trust those tests. I say, well, you know, take out dairy completely for 30 days and then add it back in, starting with ghee, which is technically casein and lactose free. Then add butter, which is almost casein and lactose free, that, you know, and I go down the list and see what happens. And that to me, that's still the gold standard for determining what you quote cross react to more than any lab panel. The lab panel might be able to give you ideas and it could be useful from that perspective, but I still want to see people remove and reintroduce. And as far as I understand, that's still the gold standard that, you know, the top people working in food allergy and immunology use.
And, you know, a question I would have is the presence of antibodies toward components of coffee. I'm not sure, it's probably a protein or something like that. Is that due to the fact that there's intestinal permeability because of the gluten intolerance in the first place?
So is it cause or effect? Yeah.
That's right. Is it secondary?
Yeah. And we could say that about any of those cross-reactive proteins. So, so my advice there would be if you're gluten intolerant, you're drinking coffee and you're not feeling good, take the coffee out for 30 days. You will survive. Trust, I don't think anyone's died from that yet, as far as I know. It can be brutal, but you'll survive. And then add it back in and see what happens.
And the last thing that I would add is not all coffee is created equal. So try several different kinds.
So let's do, this is Jennifer from Facebook. Sorry to steal your thunder here, Steve, but I'm going to modify this question a little bit. So this is something we didn't talk about, Matt, directly at least, but let's briefly talk about pseudo grains.
Pseudo cereals. Yeah. So people will know, seeds, you know, grains are the seeds of grasses, whereas pseudo cereals are the seeds of broadleaf plants. But they're all seeds. And if you, again, if you look at the nutrient density of them, it's fairly low. And if you, a lot of people say, oh, quinoa is a good source of protein. Again, if you look at the protein content, there's protein there, but the bioavailability of that protein is not as high as the bioavailability of protein in animal products. Again, because of digestion. Well, actually, in digestion in this case, less absorption. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where if you tolerate it, can you have some? Sure. Should it be the bulk of your diet? No, absolutely not. Whether you're vegetarian or not, if you're a vegetarian, you're looking for calories, go get some of those calories in some healthy fats like avocados, coconut, and then go get yourself some potatoes and sweet potatoes for some protein and carbohydrate. But the quinoa, just those, all those things are going to be far more nutrient dense than the quinoa.
Mm-hmm. And it's important to point out here, you know, groups like the Weston A. Price Foundation have been talking about this for a while, that all cultures that ate these kind of seeds as a regular part of their diet went through extensive preparation methods to do so.
Yeah, they, normalization, fermentation, and
There's no traditional group that ate unfermented, unprepared grains as a regular part of their diet, period, that we know of. So if you're going to eat quinoa, if you're going to eat millet or amaranth or any other grain for that matter, make sure to prepare it properly. And there are different because of the amount of phytase in some, for example, if you're trying to reduce the phytic acid content and make some of the minerals more bioavailable in these grains, the amount of time or the extensiveness of the preparation that you have to go through depends to some extent on how much phytase is present in the grain. So yeah. Certain grains will need much more preparation than others in order to reduce the phytic acid content. For oats, for example, happen to need a lot of preparation, as does brown rice. Whereas something like buckwheat has a significant amount of phytase in it and may not need as much preparation as the brown rice and the oats. So it's because you're dealing with toxins and you're dealing with, I know you've talked about this, Matt, plants, there's a reason that they have these things in them. Plants, like any other living thing, needs to survive. And in a natural environment, you know, humans and other mammals can run away from predators. Plants cannot. They're just sitting there in the ground. So they had to develop other defense mechanisms, and these are these defense mechanisms.
And that's one of the reasons why they're also more difficult to digest.
Exactly. And because one of the ways that seeds get spread around is in poop. So if a mammal eats the seed, it's in the seed's best interest not to be completely digested, right? So it can pass out of in the stool and into a new place and spread itself around. So our ancestors knew this intuitively. They obviously weren't doing any studies on it, but they figured it out through trial and error, and they always went through great lengths to prepare these. So from my perspective, and I think this is what you were getting at, Matt, I'd much rather just throw a sweet potato in the oven and not go through all this trouble. But if people want to do that, I have no problem with that. And I think that you can't really make a solid scientific argument against doing it if you're going to go through all the extensive preparation. But even after that, the amount of nutrients that are available from that food is still going to be less than all the other foods that we've talked about as the basis of the paleo diet.
Agreed.
All right. We did it.
Great.
Matt, well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a pleasure to have you.
It's a pleasure always, Chris, in all seriousness. I do listen to the podcast every time it comes around, and it's, I don't have that much time in a day, but this is one of the podcasts that I take the time to listen to.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate you busting my chops when I need it, and even calling me a dirt-worshipping hippie at times. So, term of endearment, I interpret it that way. So I look forward to meeting you at AHS, by the way, in your backyard.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Matt, if anybody wants to get more of your information or more of your talks, where can they find you?
They can't. Actually, but that's not necessarily true. I do have a talk online right now through the OPT website, Optimum Performance Training. It's a little dated, and actually a lot of the stuff that we talked about here, it's still in there. So you can see me make all the mistakes, and I learn from my mistakes, and I'm very honest about that. And when I make mistakes, I correct them. I'm not the type that says, no, that will refuse to change just because I don't want to be wrong. That's not me. But it is on there. We'll record a new one shortly that should be more complete and to the point. But that's where they can find some information. Aside from that, I post some stuff on Facebook, but I'm not a huge like blogger. I don't have a blog. I don't have a podcast or anything like that.
Matt's got a real job. He's got other stuff to do.
he's like the FBI. He just swoops in and lays down the law and then gets out.
I'm glad we have folks like Matt that are spending their time, you know, reading the literature, researching and doing that kind of stuff instead of posting on Facebook all day. So we can go ask Matt when we need some clarification.
Agreed.
Just don't do it on my Facebook page.
Awesome. Well, we want to thank everyone for listening today. Please keep sending us your questions at chriskresser.com. And if you enjoyed the show, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review.